Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Tuesday, May 6th. Hawaii is locked in a new battle with President Donald Trump over climate change. The administration raced to the courthouse last week in a preemptive strike against anticipated lawsuits aimed at oil companies. Trials for three men indicted in a public corruption scandal on the Big Island begins next week. We talk to the journalist whose story helped the federal probe. And think the price of your plate lunch is already high? Well, tariffs could tip the scales on that takeout order. Wedding bells for minors, why the practice is still legal in Hawaii. And we mark the passing of a surfer great, as well as a longtime Honolulu City Council member and member of the HPR Ohana. Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Earlier this year, Governor Josh Green signaled the state's plans to take the fossil fuel industry to court. But the Trump administration got to the courthouse steps first and filed a preemptive strike against Hawaii and Michigan last Wednesday. Both states had been considering lawsuits seeking damages from major oil companies for the impact of fossil fuels on climate change. The day before Hawaii filed its lawsuit, the U.S. Department of Justice filed its own complaint. It filed an executive order issued by President Donald Trump that called on the DOJ to block states from pursuing legal action related to greenhouse gas emissions. Hawaii Attorney General Ann Lopez says while the DOJ's lawsuit was unprecedented, she's not surprised the federal government made a move against Hawaii in light of the executive order.
This administration has demonstrated a willingness to retaliate against anyone and everyone who will not fall in line with whatever their latest policy idea is. And they were clear that they would consider suing states that pursued not just climate change litigation, but actually climate change policies within the state. And so I think we were all surprised by this lawsuit because it is so nonsensical, but we're not surprised that they would seek to retaliate.
And HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote spoke with Richard Walsgrove, the co-director of the Environmental Law Program at the University of Hawaii's Law School. To start off, the DOJ sued the state over an action that had yet to take place. So can they do that?
In our legal system, anybody can file a complaint about anything. And ultimately, the question is, you know, does the complaint have merit? And if not, it would be dismissed. And then also in terms of our professional ethics as lawyers, there are potentially sanctions if you file a complaint that does not have reasonable footing in the law. So yes, the federal government can file this complaint. There's a federal law that allows the government to seek a declaration from the courts on a topic before it ripens into a full-blown dispute. And that's the statute that the federal government has cited in their complaint in this lawsuit against the state of Hawaii. But I'm not aware that that's ever been used when you know that there's a lawsuit about to be filed. In other words, we know there is a court who's going to be hearing this case. The federal government could go intervene in the case that the state of Hawaii filed. And I don't think the federal law allowing us to seek declaratory relief has ever been used in this particular way.
Okay. When might we get an understanding from the courts about whether or not this case from filed by the U.S. Department of Justice will move forward?
Our legal system is designed to be deliberative and it takes time. So I don't have a good forecast of how long that will take. When you file a complaint, the party against whom you filed it gets an opportunity to answer the complaint. And then there are opportunities to seek dismissal of the complaint. I think it could take quite some time. Although before any of that happens, what I would expect the federal government to do here is to amend their complaint. You know, given that at the time they filed it, they didn't actually know what Hawaii's lawsuit was going to include. Now that they know what that lawsuit includes, I assume they'd amend the complaint to make their allegations specific to Hawaii's legal action.
And several states and even more municipalities, including Maui County and Honolulu County, have filed lawsuits in the past against the oil industry on similar grounds to the state suit, that the oil companies had misled the public about the role of fossil fuels and climate change. why did the Department of Justice take action preemptively against the state of Hawaii as well as Michigan for cases they had not yet filed rather than targeting any of the existing cases filed by states and municipalities?
That's precisely the right question to ask when we're trying to understand such an unprecedented legal maneuver by the federal government. My best guess is that this is an attempt to squash the state of Hawaii's complaint and the other states who haven't filed yet, to squash it before it ever sees the light of day. It's probably an attempt to get the first step in media coverage. It's sort of using the court as a site of sort of cultural performance as opposed to a place where you go to seek legal relief. In the context of these lawsuits that have already been filed, we know that the executive order issued by President Trump calls for the Attorney General to prepare a report on what the federal government might be able to do. And one of the things they could do in any of those lawsuits is seek to intervene. And so it would be odd to go and file a separate lawsuit if there was already a court that you could go and seek to intervene in here. The choice to preemptively file something in federal court probably reflects the overarching strategy. It's the same strategy that the oil companies have attempted to use, but has been rejected by the courts. And that is, they'd like to move all of these lawsuits into federal court and to apply federal law, even though these lawsuits are premised on state law. And so it's a little bit of a jurisdictional tussle between the various parties.
And that executive order that you referenced, that's protecting American energy from state overreach, I assume.
That's the title of it. I don't think that's what the executive order actually attempts to do.
Okay. And you and I discussed that just a week ago or so, and that was issued by President Trump, and it called on the U.S. Department of Justice to blot states from enforcing climate change laws, as well as pursuing legal action against oil companies for the role of greenhouse gas emissions or attempts to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. Was this sort of action from the Justice Department anywhere on your bingo card for actions that might stem from that executive order?
For the plain reason that I think that the action the federal government has taken here is unprecedented. I didn't see it coming. And I don't think any of us really knew before Governor Green mentioned it earlier in the week that the state of Hawaii was planning to file this lawsuit. So my answer is no, this wasn't on my radar when we first looked at President Trump's executive order.
I want to talk a little bit about the complaint itself. So the Department of Justice complaint is arguing that the state of Hawaii is essentially trying to go outside of its jurisdiction by regulating greenhouse gas emissions beyond state borders. Do you see grounds for that argument?
It looks to me to be almost precisely the same argument that the oil companies have made in response to Honolulu and Maui's lawsuits and various other lawsuits filed by other state and local governments. And those are the arguments that were used by the oil companies in their attempt to move those complaints into or move those lawsuits into federal court and to preempt them using federal law. And we've had federal district courts, federal appellate courts reject those arguments. We've had a request from the oil companies to have the U.S. Supreme Court take up those arguments and decide that states don't have jurisdiction over these claims. Ultimately, the U.S. Supreme Court asked for the U.S. Solicitor General's input on that and declined to take up the case. So the law of the land today is that the arguments pressed forward in the Department of Justice's new complaint have no merit.
And let's go back to Honolulu and Maui County's lawsuits, which again were filed in 2020. Is there anything about the trajectory of those cases, how they've moved through the courts, that can give us some insight in how the state's case may move forward?
I'd expect the defenses to be very similar in both sets of cases. And I'd expect some of the procedural maneuvering to be very similar in both sets of cases. For example, I'd expect the oil companies to try again to move the Hawaii's complaint into federal court and to dismiss it on the ground that it's preempted by federal law. So I think we do have a little bit of a roadmap of how things will proceed. But there's an interesting development here, which is that the claims alleged in Hawaii's lawsuit are not identical to the claims alleged in Honolulu and Maui's lawsuit. And for somebody who tracks the law pretty closely, the differences are fascinating. They're fascinating in a number of ways, but I can point to two. One is the state has alleged that the oil company's deceptive marketing practices around fossil fuels have damaged damaged public trust resources here in Hawaii. That's related to the constitutional obligation the state has to protect resources like clean air and clean water for the benefit of present and future generations of people in Hawaii. We didn't see that same claim levied in the Honolulu and Maui suits, but it was a similar claim as was made in the famous Nawahine lawsuit, where Hawaii's youth sued the state government about climate emissions emanating from the transportation sector. So it'd be interesting for us to observe how courts treat that public trust claim. And I don't think we have much of a roadmap from the Honolulu and Maui lawsuits on that regard. The other aspect of the state's complaint that I find pretty interesting is that they have alleged a statutory consumer protection claim. There's a statute in Hawaii that bars unfair or deceptive acts or practices in commerce. It's a very powerful consumer protection statute. It's powerful because it allows for the recovery of three times whatever the damages are from that deceptive practice. So, you know, if I can prove that a company engaged in deceptive practices that injured me to the tune of $10,000, a court would be allowed to give me $30,000 in return. That's part of what makes it so powerful. The statute also allows a plaintiff to recover their attorney's fees, which makes it, again, pretty powerful. So the differences between the two sets of complaints are as interesting to me as their similarities.
That was Richard Walsgrove, co-director of the Environmental Law Program at the William S. Richardson School of Law. He spoke with HBR's Savannah Harriman-Pote about the lawsuits that the state of Hawaii, Maui County, and Honolulu County are pursuing against oil companies.
Support for HPR comes from Maui Divers Jewelry, offering made-in-Hawaii jewelry to celebrate each individual and their stories since 1959, located across the islands and at mauidivers.com.
Years ago, a county housing story that the monthly newsletter Environment Hawaii published caught the eye of federal law enforcement agents. An FBI probe led to indictments of several Big Island residents. One, a county housing official, pled guilty to taking bribes and is awaiting sentencing. Three others, including two attorneys, are going to trial next week in the fraud case. And those attorneys are under investigation by the Office of Disciplinary Counsel. Pat Tummins is the editor of the online news service based on the Big Island. She talked with us this morning for an update on the public corruption case.
There's a Big Island civil engineer who started a business in Puna. His name is Rajesh Buddhabadi. There's a Big Island lawyer called Gary Zamber and another Big Island lawyer, Paul Sula. And those are the three defendants. The fourth man charged in the case is Alan Rudo, and he's pleaded guilty back in 2022. He hasn't been sentenced yet because he has to testify against his co-conspirators, you could say. The government says that the total amount of the deceit that was perpetrated on the county came to more than $10 million. And of that, they've restored most of it by claiming properties or getting restitution, whatever. Rudo himself turned over about $2 million. So that's kind of the bare bones of the trial.
And you have been tracking this from the Big Island, based on the court records, the filings?
And county records, yeah, court and county.
And there have been a number of interesting pretrial motions that you've been
looking
at?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Yes. You know, the motion that one of the defendants didn't want the county to use the term scam or shell with respect to the companies that were involved. Another one, Paul Sula didn't want the government to be able to use any of the statements that he had made to the state's Office of Disciplinary Counsel, which disciplined him in 2023 and has now got an active case looking into his activities in relation to this development. The other attorney, Gary Zamber, also has an ODC case ongoing against him. So I just learned so much, and I don't know how much of it will actually be introduced at trial, but, you know, all of the court records, for the most part, are public. And so I just found it an endless source of information. One of the most interesting things, I believe, is now the federal government has added to the counts to go back into 2014 and include a development in 2014 where, again, it was the same scheme where land was purchased using and housing credits were obtained and sold. And I had no idea that any of this was going on back in 2014. None of it registered with, you know, I'm not a somebody who reports regularly on the county housing office. So it's just been fascinating to look at all of the pretrial documents.
Well, it must be gratifying, though, knowing that something that just didn't feel right to you as a journalist in a story you were covering then, you know, just mushroomed into these indictments, you know, after all these years.
It was very, very interesting to write about this. I don't know, probably my reader's eyes just glazed over at a certain point. But one of the things that I'm pretty disturbed by is how slow the government was to bring the indictments. I mean, they were talking with Gary Zamber in 2021, 2 years before the indictments came down. And they had pretty much admissions from Zamber. I just don't understand why this took so long.
Yeah, unless they were holding out for bigger fish. Still, you know, at the end of the day, you have these indictments, you have one guilty plea, and then the trial for the other folks as well.
Yeah, it's just been a, you know, one of the more interesting stories that I've been party to, I would have to say.
Well, you know, you've been plugging away there, you know, on the Big Island for decades.
Yeah.
With Environment Hawaii. And this just goes to show, I think, the value of that local reporting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, Environment Hawaii really is statewide. So we you know, I just don't cover issues on the Big Island. But given that this was a Big Island issue, it made it kind of easier to cover.
Well, Pat,
I could just drive to the county office.
Yes. Well, Pat Tummins, thank you so much for your work.
All of the articles that we published are available online, just an FYI.
All right. Okay. So if folks want to read more, they can head to Environment Hawaii.
Yeah.
Thanks
okay,
so much.
Good talking, Catherine. Bye-bye.
That was Pat Tummins of Environment Hawaii talking about a public corruption case that led to a guilty plea from a county housing official. Law enforcement accredited Tummins in her reporting for getting their attention, which led to the indictments. Trial is to begin next week here in Honolulu in federal court before Judge Jill Otake. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. We're planning a live broadcast from the heart of Waikiki this Thursday as we take a look at the challenges of life on the edge. So for today's quiz, we're delving into the history of one Waikiki Beach landmark that forever changed the landscape around it. At the start of the 1900s, a major construction effort took place in Waikiki. Major E. Eveleth Winslow brought a hydraulic dredge to the area that blasted through an offshore reef and dredged a channel to the shoreline. The last stage of the construction process involved bringing two 69-ton guns to the site. A young brother's barge brought the cannons from Pearl Harbor along the coast. We'll tell you what happened next, later in the show. But for today's quiz, we want to know, what Waikiki landmark are we talking about? Call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. Pick up a HPR reusable tote bag if you're the one to get it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
When Ethan Cross was a child, there was one day each year when his grandmother shared stories about surviving the Holocaust.
What I later realized is what my grandmother was doing is she was being strategic in terms of allowing herself to think about what she went through.
Managing difficult emotions, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from Highway Inn Hawaiian Food, located in Kaka'ako, Waipahu, and Bishop Museum. Catering and shipping packaged dishes to the continental U.S. also available. Group reservations at myhighwayinn.com.
Brace yourselves. All this tariff talk could impact takeout at your favorite restaurant. Elio Products is a Hawaii-based importer of pet and eco-friendly products, including the Malama Eco line of compostable takeout containers. David Pang co-founded the company back in 2008. He spoke with The Conversation's D.W. Gibson about how tariffs are affecting business. Pang starts by telling the story of how dramatic changes to the Chinese tariffs impacted him while he was on a flight bound for Shanghai. It was a trip to purchase machinery to expand local manufacturing here in Hawaii.
Myself and another business associate were flying out to Shanghai to look at a few equipment in the process of we were going to actually manufacture products in Hawaii with these machineries and sell it around the world. So I believe we took off on April 2nd here. When we took off, the duties on the machine was at, I think it was 35 plus, thinking 2 weeks later it was going to be 45, right? So we're like, okay, let's get this under the wire. And, you know, even though it'd be more expensive, we're like, okay, we're still doable. We took off from here to Shanghai. We stopped in Tokyo on our way. Our flight was delayed. So instead of getting at, you know, 11 or midnight, we got in at 2 in the morning. And when I landed, my phone was literally blowing up and exploding. Wait, well, it was like, hey, how are we going to do this 125%? I'm like, what 125%? And I pulled up CNN. I looked at it like, what? Wait, the tariff just went from 35 to 125 from the time I flew from Honolulu to Shanghai. I'm like, okay, I am too tired to deal with this right now. Let me get some shut eye. We had an 11 o'clock meeting with the manufacturer of the machinery. And when I woke up, it was at 145. So obviously, at 145%, it is literally economically unfeasible to do what we were going to do as a test pilot program for Hawaii. So we were there. We saw the machines. It did everything we wanted it to do. But we couldn't place the PO because we couldn't afford to pay that extra 145% duty.
And this is machinery that helps produce some of the products that you provide to people here in the islands.
Yeah. And this one here, we were actually going to export out to other countries. So that was going to benefit, right? I mean, we don't have machinery here in Hawaii. No one's making machines here. So we have to buy it from somewhere. But yeah, we're going to take Hawaii products. And what it really was we were going to take leftover waste products from, you know, whether the fishery and things like that, and produce it into a dog treat made in Hawaii and sell it around the world. We have two sides of our business, right? The pet side that people may know if you have a pet or dog, right? Elio Products. And then the Malama side, which has been around for almost 17 years now. It's been around for a minute.
I think when people talk about tariffs, conversations often go to costs of big things like staples, automobiles and clothing and food. But we don't necessarily even think about the business you're in, packaging that food.
Yes, you're right. I mean, you know, when you go to your plate lunch place, chances are you're using mine or one of my competitors' clamshells and the utensils to eat that plate lunch, right? If you're going to have a picnic with your family on the beach, you're not going to bring your dishes from your house. You're going to buy, you know, Malama Eco plates and utensils and take it on the beach and eat it and, you know, get it composted when it's done.
give us a breakdown in terms of the products you supply to restaurants and stores and so forth. How much of that comes from abroad?
All of it. I mean, literally, there's a handful of companies here in the United States that makes similar but not identical products. And most of those are absorbed by the big guys, you know, the Walmarts and the Costcos and the Dixies and, you know, Chinettes, right? They basically take up all that capacity. And there is just no space for, you know, smaller, middle-sized, small business people to operate. So whether you're talking about plates or utensils or clamshells or containers, takeout containers, right, there is very little, if any, capacity left in the United States that aren't being absorbed by the big guys. So we're really left with nowhere to go. And on top of that, the technology that's being used abroad is actually much more advanced and much more eco-friendly than we have here in the U.S. Most of these other countries already have non-plastic laws in place. Some of them much more stringent than Hawaii's. India basically says no more plastics, no more plastic straws, and no more plastic utensils. So they're going that way. They're making bamboo utensils. They're making wood utensils. And they see the ramifications of the plastic single-use, non-compostable, non-biodegradable damage that's causing in those countries. So the government made a choice to do it. Taiwan's done it. You know, other countries have done it as well.
You know, you told us about that plane ride you had to Shanghai and how the news changed so dramatically even in the course of that day or so.
Not days, hours.
Yeah. So but how is that changing your approach to work right now?
Well, I'll be in four countries in the next 6 weeks. And part of this is look for new supply chains, but also some of this also secures some of our current supply chains, right? And, you know, let them know we're committed to them and that we'll figure this out and work together. Because at the end of the day, I think all business, whether you sell plates or you sell microphones, right? It is a people business and we try to keep that intact. But as far as for us right now, we have no idea. We basically, I wake up every morning, I look at the news and see, okay, what do I have? What fires do I have to put out today? How do I get through the day? Right. If someone's calling me, ask me for prices, how do I get them the best possible price at this very moment with the full understanding that, hey, it might change tomorrow, buddy? You know, and it is very difficult. It's hard to constantly be shifting right, left, forward, back, up, down without any kind of floor or ceiling around that allows you to basically project out 4 to 6 weeks, which, you know, the time usually takes things to get here and you don't know.
So what are you hearing from all of these suppliers you're going to go visit and others? What are you hearing from them?
I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but there's really nothing good. I mean, even if there was a deal signed today, the backlog of the ships and the products that are being backed up and not being ordered, you're talking about a month and a half, 2 months out. A good buddy of mine who's been in the shipping industry for way longer than I have, you know, he did a calculation over the weekend and we're talking about this. And he figured for every week we delay, it's a 2 month push out for that week to get caught up in the future. Right. So if we are delayed for the next 4 weeks, it will take the supply chain about 8 months to get caught up.
And that's remarkable.
That's scary.
Yeah.
Right. We're on an island. We get 95% of our stuff from somewhere else. It's going to take us 8 months if this thing goes out a week. What does the shelves look like? I mean, you thought COVID was bad? I mean, let's just be honest about this. This makes absolutely no sense. And the worst part of this, when I talk to my suppliers abroad, they're like, we all got COVID. There was nothing anyone controlled, but this is all self-inflicted. I mean, they have some very choice words for the people of the United States and their choice for elections. I don't think I'm allowed to say on the radio. But they also like couldn't believe that somebody would literally destroy the strongest economy in the world. They cannot see the reasoning behind it. You know, most of these countries, these people are businessmen. Everything is analytical to them, right? It's got to make sense for it to be done. And they just can't see where any of this makes any sense. And I get it. You know, I get when you say we want to bring manufacturing back to the United States, but I have two issues with that. One is we don't have the capacity as a government, as a country, as an infrastructure to do it. We don't. Number two, who's going to work that job? I know I'm not. I'm not going to work the assembly line. DWU, anybody else I know, they're not going to work that assembly line, right? Because you're low value items. If we're building, you know, Caterpillar, you know, tractors and things like that, I get that. Ford cars, you know, but you're making a 2 cent plate. And most of that is fully automated. I can tell you this. When I started doing this, you know, 17 years ago, for every assembly line, there's about 7 people working the line. Now, pretty much every one of my manufacturers, they have 1 person working the line. Everything's automated. So what are we bringing back here?
That was something that was accelerated during COVID,
yes.
No?
I think you saw
in China.
Yeah. So they were going, not just China, everywhere, whether it's India, Vietnam, Thailand, right? I think COVID just accelerated that. I think they were all going that way, like, okay, I'm going to have one automated machine, but I'm going to keep, and then COVID just, they realized, I don't have people to put this thing together. So just about everyone I know went either semi or fully automatic. Right. Semi is basically someone putting it in and someone taking it out. The fully automatic is basically someone is catching it at the end, is ready to just basically tape up the box.
So even if there were some rosy picture you could paint where, yeah, let's bring all this manufacturing back to the States, what you're telling us is even in that scenario, that's not generating jobs.
No. We hate to say it, but a retail store selling sunglasses is going to employ more people than a full assembly line making plates, making any of these lower end items, because it's automated. Because the reality is the employment price in China and everywhere else in Asia that's still cheaper than the U.S. has also gone up. So, you know, the owners have seen their margin compress. They've seen their profit bottom line get smaller. What happens when people call in sick? Right? We have that problem here with our people, right? Machines don't call in sick.
And I'm imagining that when the headlines were coming out about announcing the tariffs and the tariff number kept going up, that maybe you and your competitors were trying to quickly grab as much inventory as you could, but that presents its own problems.
Yeah. Right? So we were very lucky. We worked with our factories. So we got 5-6 containers under the line, so to speak, right? But now I have a problem. They're all landing. I have no place to put them. So now I'm paying storage fees. So that makes my costs go up. So when the price goes, when that inventory comes in to be sold now, I got to raise the price because I got to cover the storage for that in advance. It's almost like damned if you do, damned if you don't. If I don't have it, then it's going to be a lot higher. If I do have it, I'm still paying more because I got to hold it somewhere. I don't have a Costco-sized warehouse, right? Our warehouse is designed to be made on basically 2-month turns. And if I'm all of a sudden holding 6 months worth of stuff, I got to put it somewhere.
You painted a picture in terms of the lag time with shipping, if we see sort of a week delay or so, what that means in terms of getting back on track. But I wonder, do you have a sense looking at things now when we might actually be seeing some of the effects of these dynamics you're talking about? Or are there places where we can already see them in stores and in restaurants?
I can see it in stores now. Like, you know, we're a real forward-facing company. Like, we're in all the stores in Hawaii, right? Whether it's Walmart, Safeway, Foodland, Times, you know, you'll see us, Don Quixote, across the street from you guys. We're in the stores. And again, we're very lucky we were able to bring in products under the line. So we're good. But I'm also seeing competitors already where their shelves are empty. We talk, you know, it's a small community. Even though we're in competition with each other, we also realize that we're all from Hawaii. We're all in the same boat at some point in time, right? So we do have discussions. And they're like, yeah, I'm out of this and I'm out of that. And I don't have anything coming in because I can't afford to bring those things in. So it's already happening. I'm already seeing it on the shelves. And then, you know, my best guess is if something doesn't happen by the end of this month, you'll see a lot more holes on the shelves.
You do business with a lot of
mom and pops,
restaurants. Yeah. How does this affect those businesses?
I just had a few phone calls this weekend, right? From people that I've never heard of. They found my name from a mutual friend and I got a phone call from people like, hey, my guy says he's limiting how much I can buy of these, how many of these I can get, or he's just raised his price on this. You know, is there something you can do to help? I'm like, well, you know, we're kind of committed to the people that we've been doing business with. We have a little bit of excess capacity, but I said, and I'm always willing to talk to people and see where things are, where they are, and try to meet them the best I can. But the reality is at some point, two things are going to happen. One of the two things are, if not both things are going to happen. One is prices are going to go way up or you're not going to have product, and might be a combination of the two in between.
We think about, I think, restaurants, there are these auxiliary issues. I mean, it's not auxiliary for you, but in terms of the business model for a restaurant, it's not the center thing seeming, right? But it's an important part of the model. And if it's not there, then that affects us all.
If you're rainbow driving and you don't have utensils and boxes, you're in essence don't have a business, right? I mean, L&L driving. I mean, pretty much you can't expect people to bring their own plates and bring their own boxes for you to fill up and take away. So, you know, it may not be top of mind for them because those kind of items have always been there and they had multiple sources for many years. Same with their food, right? So, you know, their focus is on food and labor, but this is here something that, you know, is going to dramatically affect everybody. I don't care what industry you're in, there's always a ripple effect. Whether you're in a restaurant industry that may affect someone that's, you know, fixing the roof on your house. Because guess what? What do those guys do every day? They're buying plate lunches.
I feel like one of the effects of the tariff news that's dizzying all the time as we try to keep up with it, that news just keeps underscoring the social fabric that's woven into our economy and how we all interact with each other.
Absolutely. That everyone is intertwined. Literally, I hate to say it, but no one's on an island, even if you're on an island, right? It is. I mean, everyone's connected. I will, you know, just like to ask everyone just to be understanding and understand that the things that are going on right now, we've never seen. Basically, we're flying and building the plane at the same time right now. You know, maybe use a good analogy. We don't know. And be a little graceful for companies, especially local companies. We're learning. We're trying. And be a little patient. If we can get that and show some aloha, that would go a long way for, I think, just getting everybody through this. And I think everybody will be better at the end of the day if we just kind of share that kind of aloha for everybody.
That was David Pang talking with HBR's G.W. Gibson about how tariffs are affecting the local economy in unexpected ways. What other parts of the economy you think are getting overlooked? Leave us a voicemail, 808-792-8217, or email us, talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Hawaii is one of the states where a minor is legally allowed to get married. The practice is outlawed in 13 states, and that number is growing. This legislative session, a bill banning the marriage of minors in Hawaii failed to get a hearing in the Senate, though it passed in the House. Here to talk about that is Honolulu Civil Beat's Christina Jedra. Good morning, Christina.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yes. So, gosh, I wasn't even aware that this was even an option here in Hawaii. And I think maybe most people don't.
Yeah, it kind of flies under the radar. It's not that common, but it remains legal for teens as young as 15 to get married. They do need parental permission, and at the age of 15, they need a judge's sign off. 16 and 17-year-olds don't need permission from the judge, but it does happen. Less than 10 cases per year in the last decade or so, but yeah, it's a law on the books.
And so why is it that the Senate, you know, wasn't behind this?
So there's one particular lawmaker who has stopped a child marriage ban from going forward in recent years, and that's Senator Joy San Buenaventura. She chairs the Health and Human Services Committee, and she has just declined to give this measure a hearing, the measure of banning child marriage without exception. So basically, you can get married at 18 and that's it. She says there are circumstances in which a youth could benefit from getting married if, for example, they're leaving an abusive family situation or they're pregnant or just want to get on their partner's health insurance. And she's kind of suspicious of national groups who are pushing for a child marriage ban. On the other hand, though, the ban proposal did get a lot of support in the House. It passed the House this year. So, you know, we'll see if this is taken up again next year.
Well, you know, a line in your story says 15-year-olds can't get a driver's license or vote in elections, but they can get married in Hawaii.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And marriage was really one way that, or perhaps the only way until last year, that teenagers could be emancipated. And that's another reason that Senator San Buenaventura supported underage marriage, is that it provided an avenue for children to basically get the rights of adults. As of last year, we do have an emancipation bill. So, you know, we'll see if that changes her mind going forward.
So the numbers have really gone down then compared to previous decades. But still, the concern is that what minors may not be capable of making a decision? I mean, what's the position of this national group?
Yeah, there's several arguments for why teenagers shouldn't be getting married. For one, most of these cases in Hawaii and nationally are underage girls marrying adult men. And inherent in that, advocates say, is the potential for coercion, for girls to be forced into these marriages, to be sort of led into an adult sexual relationship that they may not be ready for. Parents also, when they're signing off on these marriages may have some self-interest at play. They, because they're handing their child over to another adult financially, so that it absolves them of financial responsibility for their kid. There's a lot of reasons. I spoke with one woman, a local woman actually, who got married at 15 back in the 70s, and her situation was her mom wanted her to be taken care of in the event that the parents passed away. She was an only child. Mom didn't want her to be left alone in this world. So she said, hey, you should marry this 21-year-old that has proposed to you. And she said, okay, Mom, you know, I will. And in that case, she had children right away, two kids before she graduated from high school, a Kamehameha, and five kids ultimately throughout her life. And she had a long and happy marriage, 50 years. But she said it wasn't easy, you know, and it slowed down her educational attainment and her career. And it was a tough journey.
Well, you know, she was fortunate to, you know, have found a partner for 50 years. I imagine there are other stories where that's not the case.
Right. And national advocates say that oftentimes these relationships can end badly when you have a sort of age gap and a power dynamic where a child is in this relationship. They may not be able to leave even if they want to. In some cases, it gets complicated and messy. And there's been this national push to put a stop to child marriage. Hawaii, though, is hanging on to its law for now.
Okay, so we'll just have to see how this plays out next year. I mean, your story mentions that there were a number of introducers in the House, so probably won't go away.
Yeah, I would imagine this will get some more discussion next year. And actually, just today, it looks like Maine has decided to outlaw child marriage. So there's one more state that has made the change.
Interesting. All right. Well, thank you so much, Christina.
Thanks, Catherine.
We've been talking to Christina Jedra. You can read her story at civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Merriman's Restaurants on Oahu, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Kauai. Details and reservations at merrimanshawaii.com.
Catch an encore presentation of the Hawaii Public Radio live from Kahilu event this coming Sunday. We've got the sweet sounds of award-winning musician Kanani Kahaunaile, as well as a rousing talk story with Manu Minute host Patrick Hart and Parker Ranch historian Dr. Billy Bergen. Catch it this Sunday at 4 on HPR 1.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute with courses for ages 50 and older at UH Manoa, community colleges, and online beginning June 2nd. OLLIUHM.org.
Now it's time to dig up the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier we told you about the history of one iconic Waikiki landmark that forever changed the area around it. To bring two massive cannons to the site in the early 1900s, workers blasted a hole through the onshore reef. What they didn't know was that breaking through the reef changed the pattern of the currents. The sand from Waikiki Beach swept through the hole, and property owners were forced to put up sea walls. As Kinau Wilder wrote in her 1978 book, Wilders of Waikiki, what had been a glorious beach, which no other beach on earth could touch, was nothing. We asked you to name the iconic landmark whose construction caused all this destruction, and we were looking for Fort DeRussy. That's today's quiz. If you enjoyed this history lesson, tune into the conversation this Thursday, May 8th at 11 a.m. We'll be broadcasting live from Waikiki Beach, where we'll be covering emergency work triggered by chronic coastal erosion. And our winner today, Susie from the Puna side of the Big Island, she got it right. She says she used to work at Fort DeRussy Community Theater and now runs a theater on the Big Island. Thank you, Susie, for calling us today. We got lots of calls on this one. That's our quiz. If you have an idea to share, send it to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org. You know, we're taking a moment at the end of the show today to remember the lives of two beloved community members who we lost this week, Clyde Aikau and John Henry Felix. Clyde Aikau, the younger brother of Eddie Aikau, was 75 years old when he died Saturday. He was a guest on The Conversation back in 2019, joining our call-in show about surfing equality on the waves with a fellow panelist, surfers Kayla Kennelly and Fred Hemmings. On that show, we spoke with Felipe Toledo, a Brazilian pro surfer who said he didn't think men and women surfers would ever compete against each other. Here's what Aikau had to say on the topic of gender parity.
To be honest with you, I'm pretty amazed on what they're doing now, the young ladies. I mean, they're doing some tight, really rail turns. They're getting up in the air and really making it work. I think personally, eventually you'll have a few girls go up against the men. I mean, to say that all girls will go up against the men, I really don't think so in the new future. But in the new future, I think one or two, even three young ladies will be the caliber of Mr. Toledo, and they would have earned their way in. It's not going to be given to them, but I can see from myself it will come.
And during our call-in show, Aikau also spoke about his own prep for the 2016 Eddie Invitational. The last year he surfed the big wave contest, he was 66 at the time.
Training for this kind of activity is crucial, you know. Back in 2016, a lot of people didn't know that I trained for 6 months. Kayla, I trained for 6 months, Freddie. Mm-hmm. Waimanalo, paddling out to the islands and back, paddling with sharks and whales. But it was a mental thing for me, because if you put yourself in this gigantic wave situations, it's mental. You know, you need to be strong-minded to survive and to be successful. So I literally trained for 6 months. And my point to the, you know, public is that if you really want to do something, you really have to sacrifice, you know.
That's it.
Easy on the McDonald's and easy on the parties and everything else. So I really prepared myself for the Eddie. And when the day came, I was really ready to rock and roll.
And lastly, he expressed gratitude for the lasting legacy that his family has left on the people of Hawaii and the world.
Well, you know, I just wanted to thank Hawaii, and I wanted to thank the world for loving Eddie Aikau and what he's all about and his legacy is all about. On that March 17th evening in 1978, when the Hokulea had, you know, turned over and capsized, you know, a lot of crew members was already sick by the time that happened. And when it capsized, because Eddie was who he was, you know, a lifesaver his whole life, felt that he could go and get help for the crew of the Hokulea. But, you know, his whole legacy lives on, and that's the whole purpose of the family and myself in the event, to keep Eddie's legacy alive and well, and to really let people know that, you know, helping other people is really what it's all about. Because when it's said and done, you know, all the money in the world won't help you or anything, but it's really what you do for your fellow man is what Eddie was all about. And I thank the surfing world and Hawaii for loving Eddie Aikau still after all these years.
That was legendary waterman Clyde Aikau, who died this past weekend at his Waimanalo home. He was 75. And we have also just lost a member of the Hawaii Public Radio Ohana. Founding member John Henry Felix was 94. He passed overnight. The former Honolulu City Council member grew up with his family in the Punchbowl area and was 11 when the attack on Pearl Harbor unfolded on December 7, 1941. Here he shares memories of that day.
As was my custom, I'd go to the top of Punchbowl every day. And it so happened on December the 7th, I was up there at the very top. And I saw these planes going back and forth. And one particular aircraft caught my eye. The canopy was open. And I waved to the pilot, and he waved back. And I could see all the explosions at Pearl Harbor. I was 11 years old at the time. And I ran down Punchbowl to my grandparents' home. They had the home up front. And advised them that the Japanese were attacking Pearl Harbor. And they said, John, go back to bed. And I turned their radio on, and the announcer made it clear that the Japanese were indeed bombing Pearl Harbor. It was a day of fear and not knowing what was going to happen next, if the Japanese would invade the island. My father became overnight an ambulance driver, and I didn't see him for 3 days. It was just chaos.
That was the voice of John Henry Felix, who was our station's inaugural chair of the Board of Directors from 1979 to 1985. Known for his philanthropy, Felix was an active supporter of the Alzheimer's Association and Scouting. He had also served as the Honorary Consul for Portugal and had long worked with the Salk Institute. In a time where a deadly measles outbreak is tearing across the U.S., his recollections about polio feel timely.
Well, my mother was very concerned about the high incidence of polio. She was a very committed fundraiser for the March of Dimes in 1938, which was the year the March of Dimes was founded by our 32nd president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. But she was a very avid supporter of the president and his efforts to control polio and finally develop a vaccine, which was funded by the March of Dimes, which got its name, by the way, from a famed Fordville actor, and the name remains to this very day.
And so people just march up to that front door and ask for dimes.
Correct. And we had little cups at the restaurants and other places where people congregate so that they can make their contributions there, dimes and dollars, whatever they had available. We have to make people more aware of what lurks in the shadows. These viruses are with us always. We must be ever vigilant. Our Board of Health, our elected officials have to be very aware of this danger and have to make the population keenly aware and make available vaccines that will control spread.
Felix saw the station, which was really established in the UH Quarry, and on at least one occasion personally helped to make payroll. He served as chief of staff for William Quinn, Hawaii's first state governor, and later in life as a Honolulu City Council member. In his capacity as CEO of Hawaiian Memorial Park, Felix donated land for our state veteran cemetery. In 2019, Hawaii Public Radio named a transmitter on Lanai in his honor, KJHF. You can hear those call letters at the top of every hour on HPR1. And John Henry Felix, know that you will be dearly missed. Well, that wraps it up for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to hear about the Hawaii Theater and the move to have the city take it over. Have memories of the historic treasure growing up? Share them. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.